Okay.
There
Did you hear that?
Yes.
Yep.
Yeah. Okay. So who's here?
Michelle.
Hi, Michelle.
Hi.
Hi, well, Amy Kay.
Hello?
Hi, Amy Kay.
Hi, Amy. And who else?
Valerie just got in.
Hi, Valerie.
Hi.
Hi, it's Kimberly.
Kimberly?
Yep.
Hi, Kimberly.
Oh.
Amy is here.
Amy. Are there two Amys then?
One Amy Kay.
Amy Kay.
Amy and Amy
Kay. Got it. Okay. Who else?
Anu.
Julie.
Hi, Anu.
Hi, Terry.
Hi. Who else?
Julie.
Hi, Julie.
Hey.
Was that someone else? Or that was just hey? Hi, who just came on?
Hi, this is Susan.
Hi, Susan. It's Terry.
Hi, Terry.
Hi. So we have Michelle and Amy Kay, Valerie, Kimberly, Amy, Anu, Julie, Susan. Anyone else? Nope, all quiet. So here we go. Hi.
Hi.
Who's Judy. This? Hi, Judy.
Hello.
This is Terry. Hi. So,
thank you for doing this.
Oh, my pleasure. I am so excited to talk about this. And I read your forum, and you guys are raising some really interesting questions. So who wants to start? Who's confused? Who's not confused?
Yeah.
I hear some giggles. So that means everybody's got this all down and understands Byron Katie. So I can ask you guys questions.
He's confused.
Pardon me?
I'm confused.
Okay, who's this?
This is Judy.
Judy.
Yes.
Tell me what your confusion is about.
Well, I think for me it's a confusion around the fact that Byron Katie's work has so much to do with compassion.
Mm-hmm.
It's hard to be compassionate when you're worried about doing it right.
Okay. And how are you worried about doing it right? You mean the work?
Yes.
Okay. So tell me about doing it right. What does that mean to you?
In terms of making sure you ask all the questions and you do it in the right order and you come up with the right turnaround. So there's a lot of internal noise that's probably interfering with my doing the work.
Okay, so what's the noise saying? Give me an example.
This is too important to screw up.
Why is it too important to screw up?
Because the work is important.
Why is it important?
Because I want to help this person.
And why do you want to help them?
I just feel this desire to be of service.
Okay. When you're doing other coaching, do you have the same fear about doing it right?
Not as much. Not as much, but while I've read the book before the coach training, again, there's this thing about the steps of it and making sure that, so the other coaching that I do, I guess, comes more naturally.
Mm-hmm.
So this is a different languaging or a different paradigm that I'm trying to use.
Okay. The language, is somebody on a cell phone or a speaker phone or changing their clothes or doing something that might be scratching at the receiver? Okay, it stopped. So the languaging, you could handle maybe fairly simple, right? If you were afraid you were going to forget the four questions, you could print those out or write them down on a piece of paper and read them.
Right.
And, you know, I lost my train of thought. You said it was the languaging and the something else that was worrying you.
Doing the steps.
Doing the steps. So what do you mean when you say doing the steps? What's that mean to you?
Oh, like asking, is it true first, and then understanding if they, it's sort of like a decision tree. I know logic-oriented.
Okay. How is it a decision tree?
Well, for example, if somebody said, is that true?
Yeah.
And someone responded, yes, it is. Well, then you probably need to ask, is it really true?
Yeah.
So it's a matter of understanding where to go in the practice of it. So I think part of my confusion is I need to give myself permission to do it and maybe do it not perfect and just
be willing to suck at it.
Right, exactly.
Okay. So can you give yourself permission to suck at it?
Yes, I can.
Okay. Now, let's talk about those two initial questions. Is it true? And the second question is, can you be absolutely certain it's true?
Mm-hmm.
Martha does it a little different. I'm trained in both. I'm going to stick with the Byron Katie part because I think that you can ask Martha. You know, Martha is very creative, and Martha finds a way to do it that works better for her.
Exactly.
So I'll speak to the way Byron Katie presents it, which question number two becomes, can you be absolutely certain that it's true? Okay?
Okay.
So understand there's no right or wrong answer. They're both yes or no, and it doesn't matter whether they say yes or no. It's
okay.
Simply to begin the thinking process. Now, if they say no to question number one,
right.
No, it's not true, well, then as a matter of logic, question number two doesn't have to be asked because that's, are you really certain that it's true?
Right.
Okay? So
mm-hmm.
does that clear up any?
Yeah, that helps. I think
yeah.
It's because it's a new skill.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, you listen to Byron Katie do it, and it just, and Martha and anybody else who's really good at it, it seems like so facile with them.
Yeah, and I just learned this, you know, last year, and I thought it was very confusing. And now that I've done it several hundred thousand times, it's real easy. I'm kidding, I haven't done it that many times. But,
But you've done it a lot, Terry.
Yeah, I have. I went to a 9-day school, mostly for myself, not because I wanted to be a better coach, but because I was in a lot of inner turmoil. And I thought, well, if Martha thinks this is good, and I actually called the hotline one night when I was in my own stuff.
Right.
And I had worn out all my girlfriends, and I thought, I just can't pester them anymore. So I went just on a fluke. It was like Monday, it started in Friday in L.A., I'm going. I'm sick of, you know, having all this turmoil and confusion inside me. So we did it lots and lots and lots of times at that school, and I got very comfortable at it. But, you know, you don't have to do that to get this process down.
Mm-hmm.
But I initially thought that the answer to question one was always supposed to be yes, and the answer to question number two was always supposed to be no. Because, yeah, it's true because that's what I'm buying into and that's what we're questioning. And no, I can't be certain because there's no certainty in anything. So when I was having the work done on me, I always answered question one, yes, and question two, no. And then I came to learn that those answers don't really matter. What this is all about is a process where we begin to understand that it's the dogma in our mind, the attachment to believing a particular version of reality that really is upsetting to us. And the version we're choosing is, of course, the most stressful, interpretation. Do you get that?
Suffering.
Right. That we're believing our thought. We're believing our stressful thought. And that's what's so upsetting. And we're letting that stressful thought drive the bus. My mother didn't love me. And I'm going to organize my entire life around that. I'm going to, do everything I can do to seek love and approval from everybody I meet. I'm going to have kids, and I'm going to prove I'm a good mother by indulging them. And I've got my whole life organized around this fear that my mother didn't love me. And I don't even realize that that's what's driving the bus. So as you question and begin to untangle our beliefs in these thoughts, it's a process that tends to free us. We tend to see that there's many other ways to look at the reality. My mother beat me because she was trained that that's the way you raise a child. She beat me because that's the way she was treated and raised, and she didn't have any other tools. She beat me because she beat me, and she's not in the room with me anymore, and I'm still acting like she is. So the mind begins to open to other possibilities and other thoughts that are friendlier, happier, more joyful, more positive. Make sense?
Yes.
Okay. So what about this fear that it's too important to screw it up and you've got to do it right? How's that feeling right now?
It's a little better. A little better. I don't feel as attached to that.
Mm-hmm.
Right now, so that's
mm-hmm.
good. That's good.
Okay. Are there any other areas in your life where I really have to do it right? I really have to do a good job. Shows up.
Oh yeah. There's probably a common theme of having to prove myself.
You have to prove yourself?
Yeah, and I really don't know who other than to myself. I was just talking to a buddy about this earlier. I said it to her, but I really was saying it to me. So that buddy that knows who she is, that really, I was doing the work on me.
Okay.
I was
so
talking
did you,
to her.
Did you do it on this belief I have to prove myself?
No, it's just something that came out of the conversation, in terms of setting a high bar for yourself or setting a standard. That sort of paralyzes you rather than frees you up.
Right, right.
Yeah.
So what is it that you have to prove about yourself?
Well, I don't know how much time you have.
No, just give me the Reader's Digest version.
It just seems like I want to do well, I want to contribute, and that's a driving force. And that somehow the contribution has to look a certain way to be valuable.
Mm-hmm. And if you don't, what's it mean?
It seems like I haven't done what I came here to do, or that I haven't proven myself valuable somehow.
So you're not valuable.
Right.
I'm not valuable unless I'm doing things to
yep.
some kind of standard.
Yep, you got it.
Okay. Would you like to do the...
I'm just going to tell you I'm welling up, so I know this is big.
Okay. Would you like to... Are you comfortable doing some work around this?
Sure, I'd love to.
Okay. So you're not valuable. You're Judy, right? Or Julie?
Yeah. Judy?
Judy? I'm sorry, okay. Judy, I'm not valuable. Is that true?
It feels true.
Okay. Can you be absolutely certain that it's true you're not valuable?
No.
How do you react when you believe the thought that you're not valuable?
I become small.
Mm-hmm.
I don't have words, there's just emotion.
And without that thought, Judy, who would you be?
I'd be a lot freer.
Yeah. It's a story, isn't it?
Well, humor is one of my tools, so I'm going to tell you it's a best-selling story in my mind.
Okay.
So,
and
yes.
Without that story, without that thought, you'd be a lot freer.
Yes.
Okay. So let's turn it around. What's the opposite of I'm not valuable?
Well, the obvious would be I am valuable.
Can you find a genuine example that's true for you that you are valuable?
Yes.
Tell me.
I have friends who love me.
Excellent. Find another example.
Make a difference at work.
Good. Find another example.
I have a loving relationship with my husband.
Good. So, Judy, do you think it could be as true or truer that you are valuable as the belief that you're not valuable?
Yes, it's possible.
It's possible that that's as true?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Let's do another turnaround. Can you see one?
I don't have to do anything to be valuable.
Okay. Let's be purists right now. Okay? We've done the opposite. When you're doing a limiting belief about self, there's not as many turnarounds. When you're doing pure Byron Katie. So let's
mm-hmm.
let's just stick with the model for right now.
Okay.
My thinking, can you find one that starts my thinking?
My thinking I'm not valuable doesn't help me.
My thinking that I'm not valuable isn't valuable.
Ah, I like it.
Give me an example of how that's true. And the more specific you can get, the better.
If I'm practicing coaching and I'm worried about being valuable, I'm not present with my client. So my thinking I'm not valuable makes me not valuable as a coach.
Excellent. Great example. Find another example.
My thinking I'm not valuable prevents me from taking risks that might value.
Great example. Find another one.
My thinking I'm not valuable limits my self-expression.
Excellent. So do you think that it could be as true or truer? My thinking I'm not valuable is not valuable? As compared to the original thought? Which one is truer?
Very true.
The original thought or the my thinking I'm not valuable is not valuable?
My thinking I'm not valuable is not valuable to anyone, including me.
Yeah. So that's the work.
Cool.
Okay.
Awesome. Thank you very much.
You're very welcome. You're very welcome. So who else has a question?
Terry, this is Amy Kay. I have a question.
Sure.
One of the things that I struggle with the work is getting through the arguing with reality. It always seems to make sense to me if Byron Katie gives an example and somebody says, you know, this should be better or this shouldn't be happening. And she says, okay, you shouldn't argue with reality because it is happening or it isn't better. And that makes complete sense until I read an example in her book where she'll say something like, you know, my dad shouldn't be hitting me or my husband shouldn't be hitting me. And she says, well, but don't argue with reality because he is. And I don't like the turnaround of he should be hitting me. And so I struggle with how to get my head around that part of the work. So if you could help me with some clarity there, that would be really appreciative.
Okay. So there's a couple of questions going on. One is the concept of arguing with reality as the source of our suffering, right? If it's happened, mm-hmm. if it's reality, and we start thinking it shouldn't be that way, my father shouldn't have hit me. There is stress around something that's already happened, that already exists, that is reality. And there's a difference between arguing with reality and approving or condoning unkind behavior. Can you draw that line in your mind that to argue with or to stop arguing with reality is not the same thing as accepting in an approving or condoning way?
Makes sense. Yes.
Okay. So she makes that point very clear. You know, we shouldn't be in the Iraq war. I mean, I can get myself really worked up over that. That's one of my buttons. I could get really worked up about that until I begin to understand that is the reality. We are at war in that country. I don't condone it. I don't approve it as a method for resolving disputes. But the reality is, if I'm stressed out about the fact that it's happened, I become less effective. My creative thinking goes away. Then I'm just this churning stomach acid person who is ineffective, who can't speak articulately. If I can speak from a calm, peaceful place and reason with somebody, I'm much more effective as a communicator, and I feel better inside.
Because those words resonate very well with me. I think what I struggle with is, let's take the Iraq war. We shouldn't be in the Iraq war, and then the arguing with reality is, but we are. And then oftentimes, mm-hmm. Katie will say, so we should be in the Iraq war because we are, so we should be.
Right.
And I go, oh, well,
right.
I still don't think we should be. We are, but I still don't think we should be.
Yeah. And, you know, this was one when I was in the 9-day school, and people were, you know, first of all, Katie is loves to tweak our minds. So you kind of got to keep that in mind as you attempt to understand her. You know, the work is powerful when you understand it experientially, right? I mean, have you done a process where you've gotten the personal understanding that, wow, that shifted something for me and I feel better now? Okay.
Yes, and that's why I just, to clarify, I'm not trying to be difficult. I'm really trying to be a better coach with this, yeah.
Oh, yeah, and I love these conversations. I'm not taking it as difficult. So going back to the arguing with reality, when we were at the school and the whole room would rise up in a whole, you know, hubbub over some of these things, and war would be one of them. She would say, who's to say that this might be the war, the situation, the political constellation of players that brings stuff into such crystal clear focus for the world that we decide we're done with war once and for all. Who's not to say that the woman who is beaten by her husband isn't the one who goes out and founds and establishes the Center for Abused Women that helped many, many other women because she had that experience? When we get into what she calls God's business, we're assuming that we know best for others. We know best for the planet. We know best for our culture. And the other point that really resonated with me was that while as long as there's war going on within us, that we are going to be at war as a culture. And she made a very sympathetic presentation of Mr. Bush and Mr. Cheney as men who walked around with fear and upset and worry within themselves about their wives, their children, their circles of people that they might care about. And those fears and upsets and internal wars, times all the people in Congress and all the people in the Senate and all the voters who support this kind of thing, really has more to do with the internal wars that we all are waging. And that's really the way we stop wars. And, you know, when I heard that, I could immediately relate to dozens of wars that I carried on within myself every day. Over the food I was eating and the clothes I was wearing and how I looked and that, and you know how it can go, right?
Mm-hmm.
Do you ever have a war inside yourself?
Oh, never. No.
Well, good.
Yeah, no, that would be, you know, a daily occurrence as well. So that makes sense. And I guess what I was hoping to is that the clarity that I was seeking is when you did the first walkthrough around the arguing with reality and not having to condone it or approve it. So when you gave the example, you know, we shouldn't be in the Iraq war, but we are at war, it still doesn't condone it. I like the fact, though, that you didn't say, you know, but we should be. And that was the thing that I guess made it resonate more is that I, you know, rather than arguing with reality, when we do that, we still don't have to condone and approve it. So that was a good clarity draw on the sand, if you want to call it that, for me.
Right. And just to clarify, Katie would say we should be because we are. And then
right.
She says, how do I know we should be? Because we are.
Right.
But that's not because we believe that war is the correct, compassionate, kind way to resolve disputes in the world.
Right. It still doesn't make it
right.
It just makes it that we don't know the answer.
Right. And when we spend our lives, and you might know some people who are so upset and agitated by the political situation that they become almost paralyzed by it. They're so ineffective. And how many dinners have I sat through going out with friends that get absolutely ruined and I leave with a stomachache because politics was the topic that the conversation inevitably returned to over and over and over again. So we were at war with that war on a Saturday night out with friends. It's not to say we... You got makes sense?
Yeah, it does. And I think that it was the turnaround that she always came back with, but, you know, you can say he shouldn't have, and it was always, of course, the dicey issues, you know, the molestation, the rape, the alcoholism, or whatever her really tough examples were, and she could go, but he did, and therefore, I was assuming that she was condoning it and saying, well, yeah, your dad should have raped you when you were five because he
did.
That's
cool.
Like, what?
What's wrong with that?
Exactly.
No,
and so
not
I guess
at
what
all.
It is that exactly he did. And so I guess what she's saying is, how do I know he should have? It's because he did. Doesn't make it right. It just teaches us that rather than being a victim, there's a purpose in how you choose to live your life today.
Exactly. Exactly. And she'll say over and over again, she'll ask, you know what the best thing about the past is? It's over.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Okay? So,
thank
who
you.
Else has, thank you. Who else has a question?
This is Michelle, and I struggle a lot with, when I'm coaching someone through it, with the question, how would you feel if you could not think that thought?
Okay.
So I guess I struggle
with...
What's
the struggle?
Yeah. The struggle is I find that the person that I'm coaching sometimes has a hard time figuring, like really feeling what it feels like to lose the thought. And so I have a hard time getting them to that place.
Okay. Are you talking about the third question or the fourth question?
The fourth question.
Without
the
thought?
How would you feel without the thought, yeah.
Okay. The fourth question is actually, who would you be without the thought?
Okay.
Okay. And our job in facilitating the work is, I'm not asking you to go there. I'm not asking you to drop the thought or drop the belief. I'm just asking you, who would you be without it? Even if it's just for a second.
Okay.
And if they can feel it for a second, they start to get it. If
okay.
they can make that little shift in there, you know, they might be so entrenched in their belief that something is true and that they really need to continue to believe that. Or more likely that there's no way they could give it up. They really can't let go of it. My husband shouldn't have had an affair. No, I mean, I can't let go of that. I refuse to go there. He shouldn't. It hurt me. It hurt the kids. It wrecked blah, blah, blah. And I don't mean blah, blah, blah in any disrespectful way. Can you drop it just for a second and answer who you would be. And so if you can get the client to let go just for a smidge, and then don't push it any further.
Okay.
And I will tell you too, sometimes a client will say to me, I can't go there. I can't tell you who I would be because I can't imagine letting go of that thought. Okay.
Yeah, I've noticed
I have
a
to,
lot.
I have to respect that. What were you saying?
Oh, I was just going to say I've noticed a lot that sometimes, you know, the client can't really go there until we get to the turnaround. And it, I don't know, it just has this effect where all of a sudden they start to open up to the idea.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, to help them understand, sometimes I'll say, we're just going to play around with this idea. We're just going to tweak your thinking a little bit. And I'm not asking you to change your mind. And I'm really honest about that. I have no agenda. So ask yourself also, do you have an agenda when you're coaching?
Mm-hmm.
Do you want them to get to a particular place? Are you trying to control the outcome?
Yeah, that's a good thought.
Yeah, it's something, when you feel tied to the result, ask yourself, what's going on? What do I want out of this, and why do I want it? As you know, to be a really effective coach, we let go of outcome. We let go of agenda. They get it or they don't get it. And maybe they'll get it today, and maybe they'll get it next year. And that's fine, as long as we're coming from a really heartfelt, open place and doing our work and doing our best job. Does that make sense?
Yeah, definitely.
Okay. Cool. Thank you. So who else has a question?
This is Julia. Can I ask a follow-up question to that?
Mm-hmm.
You're saying about coaches having an agenda and wanting to control the outcome. Can you answer what motives, known or unknown, a coach might have for preferring one outcome over another? How, if we're recognizing that we're controlling, is there a known reason for that that you can explain or that you've come across or you've experienced?
I can tell you what my experience is, but I think motives for wanting to control an outcome are probably infinite and
mm-hmm.
related to the coach that's got the motive.
Well, I guess I don't quite get why, when that would happen or what motive you might be sort of cheering for. You know what
okay.
I mean?
I'll give you a great example that came up for me the other day. Okay? I have a new client who happens to be somebody that I've known for 20 years who happens to be very well connected, knows lots of people, and I was so delighted when she asked me to coach her. And my imagination and creative mind started going to town with that. Oh, boy, you know, I'm going to do such a great job with her, and she's going to tell all these people, and I'm going to get so much business out of this. I'm going to do a great job, and I want her to succeed. It's my motive.
Oh, yeah, I would have the same. Uh-huh.
Okay.
I'm just trying to get an example of what you meant by, like, I could see if you were coaching it within your family, you might have a situation where you feel like they should agree with me or they
mm-hmm.
should, you know, he or she should see this because I've wanted her to for 5 years or whatever.
Right. That's not a clean place to come into coaching from.
Right. That's what I mean. I could see in your family members it's hard to give up your desire to make it.
Right.
You know what I mean? You might be coaching them basically to convince them, which is a different thing from coaching.
Right.
Right. But I couldn't see where you were headed, what you meant in the other.
Right, right. Excuse me. Okay. Yeah. Yeah.
Terry, could I just, this is Michelle again. I just wanted to say,
mm-hmm.
for me, with this particular client, I think maybe what was getting in the way is feeling like I wanted her to, you know, get to the point where she felt okay with the thought. So I guess my hidden, you know, it's not a friend of mine, but I just felt like I want to get her there because I want her to see value. I want her to feel like she's, you know, making progress.
Right, right, which is very similar to what I went through with this client that I had the other day. And when she wasn't, boy, was I getting frustrated. It's like, you know, when you see your whole house of cards begin to tumble down. Well, now she's not going to go out and tell 25 people what a great coach I am, and I'm going to lose all that business that I never had. Right? I'm going to lose this opportunity to expand my practice because she's not doing what I think she should be doing here, which is to feel better about her situation. And it might be for a different reason. It might be, you know, something else going on inside you. I want her to feel okay. So why do you want her to feel okay?
I guess because I feel like that's what my role is as a coach.
Is that what your role is as a coach?
Probably not.
Is that an agenda? I want her to feel okay?
I guess it sort of comes back to the same thing that you were talking about. Actually, the two themes that we've talked about. One is having value, and I have value if I give my client value. And then also sort of what you were talking about, you know, not necessarily wanting her to refer business to me, but thinking that I'm a good coach.
Mm-hmm. I want her to think I'm a good coach so I can think I'm a good coach. That'll prove it to me.
That'll validate the value that...
Yeah. And if she doesn't prove it to me, then how am I going to know?
Mm-hmm.
Again, you're looking for the external validation.
Yeah.
So how can you know you're a good coach without looking to her?
I guess just feeling, I don't know, it's hard, feeling good about coming from a good place, leaving my issues out of it.
Well, yeah, and noticing what your issues are and going after them separately, mm-hmm. apart from her. Where do I feel I don't have value? Where do I feel incompetent? Where do I feel weak? Where do I feel shaky? Where do I feel I don't have value? Because I'm looking for my value outside of myself. So, would you like to do the process around that thought?
Sure.
Okay. So let me look here. My client should value my services.
Okay.
Does that do it for you?
Yeah. Feels okay. Pretty real.
Pardon me?
It feels real. Is that what we're looking at? The thought to dissolve is my client should find value
yeah.
in me? Okay.
My client should value my services.
Okay.
Or should value my coaching. How about that one? My client should value my coaching.
Okay.
Okay. Is that true?
No.
How do you react when you believe the thought, my client should value my coaching, and she doesn't?
Anxious, disappointed, sick to my stomach.
And who would you be without the thought, my client should value my coaching?
Probably a much more valuable coach.
Okay, tell me without the probably.
Okay. A much more valuable coach.
And how would that be more valuable?
To me as a person? Is that what you mean?
Mm-hmm. Who would you be without that thought?
I would be a lot lighter. I wouldn't be carrying around the additional stress of having to be a valuable coach.
Mm-hmm.
More confident.
So turn it around. My client should value my coaching.
I should value my coaching.
I should value my coaching. Find a genuine example of how that could be true. How might it be true?
Yeah, I mean, trying to come up with a way. I'm doing it for me.
Does that feel true for you?
No. I'll be a better coach if I value my coaching.
Does that one seem true to you?
That one seems a lot more true.
Yeah, I'll be a bit more effective coach when I value my coaching. Can you find another example?
I'll value myself more if I value my coaching.
Does that one seem true to you?
Yeah.
Is there a question there?
No, it doesn't seem quite as on point as the other one.
Okay. That's all right. Find another example.
This is a tough one for me. It's obviously an issue I need to work through.
Well, we're just talking about the thoughts here. I can find an example. Would you like to hear it?
Sure.
I should value my coaching because when I do, I feel lighter and without stress and more confident.
Yeah. That feels very good.
Yeah. So do you think it's as true or truer than the original thought, I should value my coaching, is as true or truer than my client should value my coaching?
Definitely.
Okay.
I feel more relaxed about it already.
Right, right. So, who else has a question?
Terry?
Mm-hmm.
I have a question. This is Anu.
Yes,
I have a client who was in a car accident 24 years ago, and in the accident she was paralyzed and she lost one of her children. And we've done a lot of work around issues of being handicapped, and but I know that there's still this big issue of the accident shouldn't have happened. That is really scary to go to that place.
Scary for her or scary for you?
Well, for me, and I just can't see, like, how do you know when it's right to go to that heavy place?
Well, if it were me, I would do my own work around it until it didn't get me going, until I felt comfortable. And you might take a look at Loving What Is, where she talks about getting comfortable or something like that with the worst thing that could happen. And again, holding an open mind, we're not condoning it, we're not approving of it. But when we have fear about a topic, it's, you know, we have a blind spot and it's difficult. It's a big challenge to coach there.
Okay, so I should do work on the idea that it's a difficult topic or that.
So what's scary about it for you?
Well, it seems kind of brutal to say to her this accident shouldn't have happened because her whole life has just been so affected by it. It's like,
it feels brutal to say.
Just to do, like, the turnaround, the accident should have happened. Like, you should have lost your child, and you should have become paralyzed. I mean, that's just, I mean, I can see in the Byron Katie world that's just what reality is. That did happen to her. But, but doing that with a client, it just seems kind of very brutal to take her there.
Well, then question why you want to take her there.
Yeah.
Why do you want to take her there?
Because it could also lead to a lot of healing.
And why do you want her to have a lot of feeling?
Healing. Well, because she has a lot of pain around that issue.
And can you, you know, I would say a couple of things anew. First of all, you wouldn't go slamming right in. I mean, this is a pretty big time situation, right?
Mm-hmm.
This isn't,
yeah.
I don't know what I, you know, I mean, it doesn't get much more intense than that kind of situation.
Right.
And so it's going to bring up all of your stuff. And you're not going to go into it slamming head on into it, you know, in the back of your mind holding the thought that the accident should have happened. Because as you said, coming head on into it like that is brutal. And if what are you coaching her around?
Well, I'm coaching her around other issues, like sort of tangentially working around it, kind of issues on being handicapped, issues on being valued by others, things like that.
Mm-hmm.
And so we've done, the work on different things, but not
okay,
yet on
so,
this big issue.
Well, why do you think you should go there?
I guess I feel like that she's still holding on to that, the accident as the big event in her life. Like in many ways, even after 24 years, she seems to still be in square one around it.
So let me ask you this. When you think about coaching her around the thought the accident shouldn't happen, where's your body go? What happens inside you?
It gets pretty tense. I get some knots in my stomach.
And what do you think that means?
Well, I think maybe it's not the right time to go there yet.
Yeah. And it might not be the time to go there because you're not ready. It might not be the time to go there because she's not ready. But you're clearly getting messages not to go there.
Okay.
Makes sense?
Yeah, it does make sense. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you. That's a great question and a great example. Who else?
This is Kimberly.
I'm
so frustrated with this should word, especially just based on a news example, because the layperson to our clients who aren't in the Byron Katie world,
mm-hmm.
I mean, that's such a tragic situation that a news client has gone through, but even less tragic wherever, anything seems brutal if something's happened. I mean, it goes back to the whole abuse, and I don't want to keep beating up on the should word, but I just am struggling with why she uses the word should, because in our culture, should is, it should have happened. It's condoning it. I agree that it was meant to be, versus why do you think it did happen, or it did happen, this is what is, what are the benefits we can find from it?
Well, isn't that what the inquiry process is about, is loosening up the thoughts and finding the benefits? When you say it should have happened, aren't you looking for the benefits?
You know, I still, maybe this is my own thing, I just still don't think should equates to finding the benefits, because I'm one who doesn't believe that everything happens for a reason, but I believe that you can find benefits in everything that happens. And you had mentioned earlier about, you know, God's work or energy or whatever. That's why it's happening, and it's not our place to say that it shouldn't have happened. I don't feel like it's our place to say it should, and I don't feel like the energy wanted it to happen. I just feel like things happen and that's the reality, and in those things we can learn and grow from it.
Right, right.
So I when a client off the street is in my office and I'm saying that, I just feel like, well, turn them off and I'll lose them the word should, and is there a way to not say it with the word should? Or does that...
Well, I think if you gave me an example, I could address this more clearly. So give me an example of...
Well, I mean, I'm really at the beginning. I haven't done any client work on this. How about
in your own life?
Okay. So let's see. I can go to my sister. We're having a terrible time in our relationship right now. But see, even then, I could say the word should with. I mean, right now, she's not talking to me, and she's not allowing me to see my nieces. And so I could say, she's being brutal to my mother, who has MS, and it's just really, literally killing my mom. So I could say she shouldn't be doing that. But in that case, I can understand where the should, I guess I could say she shouldn't be doing that. She is doing this, and having compassion for her, and this is where she's at, and she's going through some demons in her life.
Right. So did you resolve your own question? I wasn't quite sure there.
No, I don't think I have.
Okay. With Anu, we're not going to whether the accident should or shouldn't have happened. Anu's body, her intuition, everything is telling her not to go there with this woman, to stay away from that ultimate question. I would probably stay away from that ultimate question if I had a client who was paralyzed 24 years ago and lost a child. I would have to do a lot of personal work and I would probably coach that woman for a long time if I ever took that one head on.
What about, okay, so someone is diagnosed with cancer.
Okay.
So I haven't had this experience, but if you're doing the work with this person and you do get to that point of the question where you say you should have gotten cancer. I mean, in any tragedy.
Beautiful example. I shouldn't have cancer. I'm going to recommend that you guys go to Byron Katie's website, thework.com, and watch the videos. And there is one of the most moving videos is around the topic of cancer. And there's a man who's lost an eye. He's sitting there with a patch over his eye, and I cry every time I watch it. And the cancer has come back, and it's growing. And the one-liner Katie works with him is the cancer shouldn't be growing. And she turns it around, or he turns it around, and he finds within himself how the cancer should be growing. And his example is that it opened his heart. It changed him in a way that he never would have changed but for this very serious medical issue that he's having. Anyone seen that video?
Yeah.
It's, I mean, I go back and watch it sometimes, even though I've seen it four or five times. It's so moving. Who are we to say that it shouldn't have happened? You know, if somebody gets that kind of profound love in their heart, that profound opening, who are we to say as outsiders that it shouldn't have happened to them? Now, it takes a lot of work, I totally admit, and there are places where I don't get it myself. This is extreme stuff, which is why it's so powerful, I believe. It's very extreme. And when I went to the school with 320 people, which was the wretched of the earth, and we stood up the first night and, you know, said a few words about why we were there, and there were addicts and alcoholics. There was a mercenary who had killed umpteen people. I mean, there were people who were haunted in that room. And to watch the profound shifts and changes and openings within them was amazing. And I still left with places where I don't get how you can accept everything that is. But once I experienced within me the shifts, I respect it as a very powerful tool. And the places I don't get, the places I still have resistance, I want to continue to look at what's in me. Is there something in me that really resists these ideas? What am I afraid of? Where am I scared? Where am I controlling my thoughts and my process around other people and their business? Does that make sense at all to you?
Yeah, it does.
Was it?
Kimberly, you mean me?
Pardon me?
Sorry, are you talking to me, Kimberly?
Yes.
Oh, yes. Yes, and actually, I had a little of an aha moment there thinking, who are we, not to say it shouldn't have happened, and I agree with that. So I guess I've just been thinking of the way of us telling the person it should have happened and why should it have happened.
Yeah, we're never going to do that. That's not kind.
Right. But it's the turnaround to it shouldn't have, and that just makes them play with it a bit.
It's just to help them open their minds to the stressful thinking.
Right.
You get in an automobile accident, and it's very common for people who've been in accidents to hold on to that it shouldn't have happened for so long, and they organize their lives around it, and the stress that's built in and the victimhood that's built in really destroys their lives. And so if you can tenderly and lovingly coach them around this, and you may just chip at the edges for a long time. You may never go head on into, my child should have had cancer because he did. You know, you're going to have to be very, very discreet with this very powerful tool and always come to it with your own clean, clear, essential self, just sparkling. I mean, we're talking about some pretty intense, tragic, major situations. But if people can let go of hanging on to the past, by continuing to insist in their minds it shouldn't have happened, it shouldn't have happened, it shouldn't have happened, and begin to let go of the grasping of that thought, the organizing of their lives around that thought, they might be able to live more joyfully.
That's great. That makes sense. Thank you.
Thank you. Great questions, you guys. How are we doing on time? I left my clock on the other side of the room. But I'll stay here. If you guys have questions, I'm happy to stay on, too. Anything else? Somebody had emailed me about this shouldn't question. Was that Susan?
That was me. Yeah, Susan.
So
I'm totally... Go ahead.
say what you were going to say.
I was just going to say this is really helpful. Thank you. I'm clear on it now.
Oh, good. Excellent. Excellent.
Yeah, I did have another question though.
Yeah.
When you start to do the work with a client,
mm-hmm.
Do you explain what you're doing, or do you just go right into the questions? How much education do you give them about the process?
You know, it depends on the client. Sometimes I will just, you know, repeat the one-liner and just say, is that true? Usually the first time I introduce it, I will say something very simple, like, this is a process that might help you question your thoughts in a way that helps people understand that a lot of our stress is caused when we cling to or we believe a stressful thought. Would you like to try it? And they always say, yeah, of course.
And when you start the process, do you often get resistance or does it flow?
It flows. I never get resistance.
Mm-hmm.
Do you get resistance?
No, I can't say I've really used it enough to say that I get resistance. Maybe there's resistance in my own mind. Can I get
resistance? That's where I would go with this. Is is there a part of you that resists?
Probably. I'm still working through some of it. I mean, I've definitely have felt the shift in myself and know how powerful it is, but I guess it goes back to that logic thing. My husband's an attorney, so he has been working on this with me, and he has lots of questions. So maybe that's where it stems from, and it's really good. I appreciate his questions because it helps me understand it completely. So I'm still I'm much farther along than when I first began, but I think that is where some of my resistance comes from.
Mm-hmm.
Just wanting to make sure I understand the concepts that are underneath what the process is about. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Sure.
So that I can ask questions that are coming from an intuitive place and not just from a list.
Right. Right. And at first it is from a list. And I'll tell you too, sometimes, if I did feel resistance, I would gently try to find out what the resistance is.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you don't want to answer that question, you know, what's coming up for you?
Mm-hmm.
Question number four, who would you be without that thought? That's often a sticking place, and I might coach around that a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
You know, can you find it just for a split second? And I'm not asking you to let go of the thought that your husband shouldn't have had an affair, that your mother didn't love you. But what if that, you know, you weren't holding that thought anymore? How would that feel? Who would you be? So I might coach a little there.
Okay.
If I really thought there was resistance, I'd back right off. Because I don't want to confront. I want to be beside my client. And sometimes I will stop the process of inquiry when my intuition gets, you know, once in a while they'll come up with something just so juicy in the middle of it. I'll just you know, the metaphor is too great to wait, and I've got 10 minutes left on the call, and, you know, wall? What do you mean a wall? How big was the wall? You know, they'll say, in question three often brings this out, how do you react when you believe that thought? I believe there's a brick wall in front of me. And if I get a hit to go there, I'll go there. I don't do it a lot, but I do it. And just go off with the metaphor tool. Does that make sense?
Okay, that makes sense. That's very helpful. Thanks.
Yeah. Okay. Any other questions? What about the one on the forum, my kids should pick up their socks? Any more juice around that one? Quiet out there. That's one that got me personally going when I first started reading this stuff.
So what's your take on that?
Well, here's my take on it. And I had two kids. I was a single mom, and I had two kids that were very creative and very curious and very messy. And I lived in stress. And, you know, when that got all my stuff going, by the time I found Byron Katie, my kids were grown and out of the house. But, you know, recalling, yeah, they should pick up their socks. And the way I came to understand it was that as a mother, when I'm letting go of the should and what they should and shouldn't do, I can approach my children with so much more fun and compassion and kindness that they're much more likely to help me keep the house in order, rather than holding on to children should pick up their socks, children should make their beds. And I recalled an incident where, when my daughter was a teenager, for a while I tried this rule that she couldn't leave until her room was neat, which meant she wound up sneaking out the window when my back was turned. That's how she resolved it. She just didn't leave by the front door anymore. She left by the window. And one night I was down in her room, and she had this very playful friend, and they wanted to go somewhere. It's like, God, can't you? You've got to clean this room up first. And her girlfriend said, okay, Amber, let's do it this way. Pick up all the pink things on the floor first. And she brightened up, and she scampered around, and she picked up, you know, all the 400 pink things on the floor. Okay, now pick up all the round things. And she ran, you know, she made it a game, because it no longer became about the struggle with my shoulds. These kids have a, you know, humans, as humans, we want to push back against something rigid in front of us. So once the struggle was gone for my daughter, that room was clean in 5 minutes. And I remembered that when I read this thing about children should pick up their socks. So if as mothers we can come to our families with a little more joy and humor, we're much more likely to get cooperation. Does that make sense?
Now, can I ask, that brings up a question for me as a mother.
Mm-hmm.
And that is not that I think my children, I very much believe my children should progress however they want to progress, because I don't know who they're going to be. But my
mm-hmm.
husband feels that they should respect requests and respect him because he asked for it. And he's pretty bottled up in that concept of asking for respect. And we've talked about it a fair amount, and I kind of come away thinking, well, if he wants to teach him that aspect of life, he didn't invent it. It's certainly out there. I don't feel like I need to interrupt him demanding that. He just is getting less from his children than he might get. So do you think that, I don't know, that just brings up a different issue for me, and that is I can't control him, but he's missing it, in my opinion. But I don't
know. Well, you know, the best way to help our families understand this is to model it. Because when you go around after your husband and you say, children should respect their father, is that true? You're going to really tick him off, is my hunch, right?
That's what I'm saying. That's not the way to go about that.
And that might not be a real respectful way to approach him either.
But so
right?
Your point of view is, yes, but your point of view is just, I guess, you're still going to have all the Sturm und Drang. It's just going to be over there and not, you know, not you but him. You
it's
know
not your business anymore, yeah. Yeah, and I'm going to live in a way, you know, I'm going to find my respect for myself and my respect for my children and my respect for their father and my respect for their relationship, and I'm going to model it. And maybe everybody's going to respect everybody because they see how well it's working for me. Maybe not, but I know once I start getting into the argument, into the debate, and how do we make a child respect somebody anyway? It's another question.
In essence, it takes anger. That's in my experience. That's why.
Well,
like
is that respect?
Not an argument I'm willing to have.
I mean, pardon me?
Yeah, that's not an argument I'm willing to enter into. So that's why I question.
Right.
So what I'm questioning here is really. It's not my business when it's any given people, but when it's my children, it becomes a little bit more my business how my children are being co-raised. Is
right.
that not true?
Well, is there an issue between you and your husband?
On that subject, yes.
Yeah. So...
See, so this is... I'm not asking you to solve my problem with my husband.
Right.
I'm asking you to look at that, my business, his business, and God's business. I think there's areas where you have blended business when you're...
It's our business, yeah. Yeah, and I tell my husband went to the school with me, and I always am telling him, yeah, but there's another kind of business that Katie didn't mention, and that's our business. That's usually when I'm trying to boss him around. Pardon me?
I believe he is kind of blind to the our business place. That came up for me when I was reading it. She doesn't seem to have an our business place at all in her
No,
teaching.
She definitely doesn't, and I don't think it's from blindness. I think it's very intentional.
Okay, so how do you deal with it is at least partially my business. We are co-raising children for whom I'm responsible, with whom I share space.
So how could you deal with this? Give me an idea of what goes on.
Well, what I have done, what goes on historically is he yells and I yell at him for yelling. And, you know, it's lovely.
Mm. How's that working?
Yeah, so I had done a turnaround on this, and I was listening to the shoulds and the should conversations and stuff. I actually did a turnaround in my head where I go, he should yell at me because guess what? I'm trying to control his conversations with his children. And it really was an eye-opener for me. It was the shift that you're talking about. I was just like, so I just really backed out of those conversations. Maybe they're getting a little better, maybe not. But I did it completely unilaterally. I just backed out of those conversations. I decided not to at least amplify just the
yelling.
Anger
yeah.
voice level. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
But it's maybe if it's marginally better at best, I'm just not entering into it anymore. But I do feel a little bit like, couldn't I make that work better? I wish I could because I feel it's still bad for them.
Well, okay. So where are you still yelling? Are you still yelling inside?
Well, it depends on how recently I've thought it all through and have it held in a little Byron Katie shrine in my head. You know, sometimes I can backslide. But I don't know if I'm still... No, I don't think I'm still yelling usually, but in my head am I? Yeah, there's still times when I just go...
He shouldn't be doing that. They shouldn't be yelling at each other. Inside.
Right. Inside, I guess that's probably true. I'm still saying this should be better.
Yeah, yeah. And if you can find more peace within yourself, you might find the family beginning to calm down. So if it was me, knowing what I know now, I would find all those places where I'm still yelling inside myself. and I would work them through with the questions and the turnarounds, or coach myself with another tool so
okay.
that I could find some peace around it. And I'm not saying that it's easy or there's going to be a quick fix, but my hunch is that your jumping into the debate may not help it quiet
down.
No, and
I've come to that. I think I've come to that at least. But like I said, I can backslide, that's for sure. So you're
yeah.
saying if I backslide, even if silently, I should take a note of that so that I can help myself not backslide. If I'm actually requested, which has also happened by a child, to mediate, it is shared business. I mean, if you know what I'm saying? It's not the same as...
Well, a mediator has no attachment to the outcome.
Okay, that's a good point of view.
You know, if you're going to mediate, it's like being a coach. You've got to come from a clean place.
Well, they don't use that word, but I would. But I see what you're saying. I'm not sure I can do that without an outcome, but I can try.
Well, then what's the outcome? What's the outcome you want? And perhaps coach yourself around that, you know? What is it I need here?
I want peace and harmony, and I want them to listen to each other and respond to each other. That's what I really want is for them to respect each other's points of view. Mutually, though, I don't think my husband wants to listen to their point of view as much as I would like him to listen to their point of view.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I'm saying?
I know.
I would like increased respect from them. I'm not saying he's wrong to seek respect from them. I'd like to increase it on both sides. I'd like them to have more empathy for each other.
So, you know, the best way I know how is to find the empathy, to find the compassion in your own heart and live it with them. And when you don't, you coach yourself around it.
Mm-hmm.
What am I doing here? What's eating at me? What am I trying to control?
Yes, I feel strongly that I made really big headway with the first turnaround because I felt completely in the right to yell at him for yelling at them until I did the Byron Katie work.
Right, right.
It seems positively silly now, but of course at the time I just felt like I was doing the right thing. I was showing him how to deal with them without yelling at them. I wasn't yelling at them, right?
Yeah. Yeah, we're interesting creatures, aren't we?
Anyway.
Well, I love it. Great, great, great example. So, anybody else got anything that they're burning up with? You can always email me. I love the conversation.
Okay.
Gets me thinking, too.
Thank you very much.
Oh,
yes,
thank you guys. You are great. You got great questions. I enjoyed it.
Thank you so much, Terry, for doing this
Thanks,
on a holiday.
Terry.
Okay. You guys take care.
You too.
Thank you.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye.